Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Nice. Good old JoJo.
Yeah. Everyone's favorite, like, 13-year-old pop star, JoJo.
She had a pretty good record a couple years ago.
Did she?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I remember this song for some reason. I think I was in college when it came out, and I was like, you know what? That's a catchy-ass song. But anyway. And now we've screwed up the entire opening. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Film Stage Show. I, of course, am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today to talk about the film Get Out, we have Bill Graham.
Who?
And Michael Snydell.
Hello.
All right. And yeah, so we played some JoJo because it should be fairly obvious. She screams Get Out, and we are talking about Get Out. And on top of
that, is that what we're talking about? Oh, okay.
This time.
Right. Yeah, not a lot of like questions going on now. It's a fairly obvious one. We will also have a very short review of Michael Snydell, who will be talking about
I don't feel at home in this world anymore.
Correct. It just struck me that I said a review of Michael Snydell, which just made it seem like Bill and I were just going to gang up on you for a second.
Oh, it's so a usual episode.
Yeah. Rough
what
start
is the
today.
Spoiler section going to be like?
Michael Snydell will die in 2022 when he is hit by a bus that is being driven by someone who passed out from a heart attack.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Anyway, let's try to recover from what has been a very rough opening. Today's episode is brought to you, as always, by Mubi. Mubi is the streaming online cinema where every day their curators deliver a new, fresh film for you to enjoy. You have 30 days to watch it before it disappears, so it's a constantly rotating, constantly upgraded queue for you to watch. This week, some very interesting stuff from Mubi. They are beginning a series called Three Views from North Korea. And this is a three-film series offering a view, albeit limited, into North Korea. So, that's been in the news a lot lately. And as the situation with the murder of the half-brother, I think, of Kim Jong-un continues...
Like, and the awesomely dressed assassin.
Yeah, who apparently thought she was on, like, a prank show? Like, who knows? The world is a crazy place, and maybe this will help to make a little more sense of it. It's Three Views from North Korea. It includes The Red Chapel, A State of Mind, and Crossing the Line. So, yeah, check that out for your free 30-day trial. All you have to do is go to Mubi, that is mubi.com/filmstage, and you will get 30 days to try out Mubi on us. Talking about us, you can follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can follow us on Facebook by searching for The Film Stage Show. You can give us a rating and a comment on iTunes, which we always appreciate, and you can email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. That is about it. We are here today, this Sunday morning, the Sunday of the Academy Awards. Guys, how super fucking excited are we for the Academy Awards?
I'm actually kind of pumped. I'm looking forward to seeing how much of a disaster Jimmy Kimmel actually is. But the awards themselves, I think, are going to be pretty interesting this year. There's a few that I really, really am hoping to see kind of sway in a different direction. And then, of course, seeing if La La Land ends up being our most decorated film ever is pretty disheartening and also intriguing at the same time.
How many does it need to win to become the most?
I think 15.
It's only nominated for 14, isn't it?
I'm sorry. I think 13 then. Yeah.
No, I thought 13 was the previous. Was that like Titanic?
I don't know. This is not something I've done a ton of research about. I've just been hearing all about it and just know that probably film Twitter is going to have like a running counter.
Yeah.
And just being like a countdown to chaos.
It's just funny because even if La La Land wins in every category that it is nominated for, it cannot win every award that it was nominated for.
Yes, because it is nominated multiple times for like the best song category and things like that. And then there's also
Guys, I just did look it up. It's it seems like the two previous record holders were Titanic and Return of the King, which are tied for 11.
So it could win like 12 or 13 and be the most decorated film of all time. In which case, we will have one more episode of this show where I will live record me blowing my fucking brains out. So and that so is Christine. A promise.
guys, La La Land, all-time classic, guys. All-time
I'm
classic.
Pull a podcast Christine and just shoot my brains out. Which means I'm going to have to teach one of you how to post these things. So if you get a long email from me after La La Land wins, you'll know why.
Don't do that. That's a lot of work.
My will stipulates who will become the new primary host of the show.
Not it.
Death. Oh, that's too bad.
Michael does not want it.
So that's we're gonna have a round table this week where we will give
Michael,
our reaction.
Michael is gonna be gifted it just like Manchester by the Sea. He's gonna be like, oh fuck.
I can't do this.
Fucking boat, guys.
Why would he do this? All right. So yes. Yes indeed. So, yeah, we're going to have a roundtable discussion of the Oscars when it's done. That'll come out probably Thursday or Friday. But we just wanted to have a brief little talk about it right now so that everyone listening at home won't be sitting there going, how can these monsters not acknowledge the massive ceremony that's about to happen mere hours from now? So, yes, we don't know who's won yet, but God, am I afraid. So let's move on. Michael Snydell, you watched a film this weekend, which I was going to try to watch as well, but did not have time for. But this is I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore.
I keep having to look up this title because it's so damn long.
this is a Netflix only kind of title, right? Only Netflix could get away with
it. At Sundance.
Yeah,
Yes, a lot of independent films have very stupid long intricate names. Oh, Jesus.
Like me
Christ.
And Earl and the Dying Girl.
Yeah.
All right. So, Michael Snydell, what did you think of I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore?
Well, I think this is actually the second time this has been, because didn't you guys talk about this in the Sundance episode for a little bit? Okay. So, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. Like, the log line and its inevitable comparison is that this is the first film directed by Macon Blair, who was the star of Jeremy Saunier's Green Room.
The star of Blue Ruin and a co-star in Green Room.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. My brain and my mouth were not saying the same things. Okay, yes, he is the star of Blue Ruin, and he is a supporting cast member in Green Room. And I think he's involved on some writing or production level. Honestly, guys, I don't remember. But this is inevitably going to be compared to Green Room and Blue Ruin because it's about two people who are way out of their depth, like normal people trying to fight back at the natural order. And so, like, you know, tapping into the feeling of right now, this is a movie starring Melanie Lynskey and Elijah Wood as two strangers who come together over their mutual distaste over the current state of the world and people just being assholes. Like, so they decide to fight back and things happen. It has more in common, if I'm going to compare it to two movies, Did either of you guys see the movie Bandits, which is Bruce Willis, Billy Bob Thornton, and Cate Blanchett? So tone-wise, this is what it really reminded me of, is this movie called Bandits and a Harold Ramis movie called The Ice Harvest. In the sense, it's about like good intentions that are like edge out like into nihilism and like spiral out of control. So what I would say about this movie is that it just doesn't have the precision and the momentum needed. It takes about like an hour and 40 minutes, I believe. And it takes about 25 minutes to really get going. For a while, it has the feeling of kind of a low key indie comedy, especially with Melanie Lynskey, like playing this very like mild mannered, a mumbly woman who's just kind of like beaten down in a doormat for a long time. But then once it really gets going, my problem with it is it just starts to feel like it's more interested in being clever than emotional. At a certain point, the movie just starts jumping into its plot. And it hasn't really identified why these characters have the relationships they do. And it just seems to kind of leave behind that relationship for just a lot of wacky things piling up. And it's occasionally funny. It's well shot. Lynskey and Wood are always people I just like seeing. It's nice to see Elijah Wood be like a weirdo creep. Like, that's just a fun role to watch. But the thing about it is it's just like, it just doesn't, it's just very disjointed, and it just feels very, very silly by the end. So I guess what I'd say is, you know, I think Macon Blair, like, he absolutely understands genre stuff, like, especially, you know, like things like Coen's Blood Simple, like neo-noir and stuff like that. But this just doesn't have the atmosphere and the sense of just like, you know, nail-biting tension that Sonnier's films have, which kind of even push through any of the flaws, in my opinion. So yeah, it's on Netflix. It won the Grand Jury Prize. It's okay. It's sometimes funny, and it's relatively entertaining, but it really doesn't amount to that much.
All right. Well, now that we've gone through that, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore is on Netflix, so check it out if you want. This is like the...
Sounds like a strong recommendation, guys.
Well, other people liked it. I was going to say, it's really crazy because usually we have to wait like a year to get something out of Sundance.
Sure.
This is like the fastest turnaround, so I almost want to watch it just because of that.
The last thing I want to say is one really cool thing is David Yao, who's formerly of the band The Jesus Lizard. He is the bad guy in this, and he just is like the best creep I've seen in a while. Just like this snarling, like old dude who's just perfect for the role. So like, there's good character work in this. It's just, you know, it's fine.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into our primary review, and that is Get Out. This is the directorial and feature directorial and debut writing premiere from Jordan Peele, who is of Key and Peele fame. And
did he not write Keanu?
Did he write
or
Keanu?
Any of Keanu?
I think that they had like story credit, but this is like his solo writing. Like he is the writer and director on this. It is his auteurish vision.
Peele co-wrote Keanu.
Yes.
Yes, I see what you're saying. I'm sorry, Brian.
Gotcha.
I just wanted to.
It's fine. It's cool. Thank you. So this. This stars Daniel Kaluuya, Allison Williams, Catherine Keener, and Bradley Whitford. And it is about a young black man who goes with his white girlfriend to visit her parents in upstate New York. And I don't want to spoil it, so let's just say it gets weird. Here is the trailer.
You got your toothbrush?
Check.
Do you have your deodorant?
Check.
Do you have your cozy clothes?
Got that.
What?
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
I ain't never seen you like this before, bruh.
Meeting families. Taking road trips, don't come back all bougie, man.
Come back, get your damn pants up to your damn stomach.
So that is the trailer for Get Out.
A trailer you should probably avoid if you have the chance.
Yes. I was going to say, well, we can get into it when we get into everything. It's hard.
Sure.
In a movie like
I just
this.
Want to say that up front.
Yes. If you somehow have not seen the trailer for Get Out, I suggest don't see the trailer for Get Out.
Even though that is absolutely what sold me on this film. Like I was,
for sure.
Like I was going to see this film probably regardless, but like when I first saw the first trailer that I kind of ran across, it gave sure. away way too much having seen the film, but it didn't give enough away to where I was like, oh, but yeah, about halfway through, I was like, holy shit, everything that's in that trailer.
Yeah, it kind of sucks because, I mean, first of all, yes, the trailer does give away way too much, which sucks. And it's also the reason I went and saw the movie. I don't know how to bridge that gap. And that's a conversation we've had to have a few times. But like, you will know possibly what's going to happen but not why it is happening, and I think that still leaves a little bit more to be felt and seen. So yes, let's stop talking about the trailer, let's start talking about the movie.
Sorry.
Bill Graham, what did you think of Get Out?
Holy shit, guys, this was one of my favorite movie going experiences. This was supremely entertaining. It cut straight to the chase. It is a no bullshit thriller. Within the first 15 minutes or within the first 20 minutes, it gets wildly out of hand and it kind of reins itself back in just a little bit and then it completely goes off the rails. This was a ton of fun. I think it's expertly crafted the way it kind of builds this racial tension. Has plenty of humor and jokes throughout the way, so it doesn't feel like a straight up horror film or something like that. It's a ton of fun to watch with an audience. I went to the Alamo Draft House, as I often do, and the audience was having a blast with it. They were laughing, they were cheering right at the right moments and things like that. It was a lot of fun to watch it with a big crowd. The acting in this is really, really well done. I'm not familiar with the main actor. He's apparently someone kind of relatively new on the scene, but I am familiar with a lot of the kind of supporting players in this film, and they're all doing excellent work. And it's just a really, really entertaining, thrilling film that has a few twists and turns that aren't jaw-droppingly stupid, and it's just extremely well made. And this is another Blumhouse production that, you know, again, along with Splice, probably cost about, you know, $7-8 million, and it looks fantastic.
I think the line on Blumhouse is that they will give you $5 million, and anything above that you kind of have to bring to it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
There was an interesting podcast. I can't remember if it was from Planet Money or Freakonomics that interviewed someone who'd worked with Blumhouse about that. Just to what you were saying about the main character, Daniel, and
Kaluuya.
Again, I apologize, Kaluuya. He is from an episode of Black Mirror called 15 Million Merits, which...
Also Sicario.
Yes, I was getting there. I was going to say, 15 Million Merits is actually an episode of Black Mirror that's grown in my estimation. And yes, he was also Emily Blunt's partner in Sicario.
Is that the American Idol-y one?
Yes.
Okay.
He was also in a show called Babylon, and he was apparently in Kick-Ass 2, so who knows. So yeah. All right, well,
budget is $4.5 million.
There you go.
Oh wow. Yeah.
And it only shows in one scene, as far as I'm concerned. But we can get into that when we get into my thoughts. Michael Snydell, what did you think of Get Out?
Yeah, I am like slightly less positive than Bill, but I think the first hour plus of this is as exhilarating and assured as any debut I've seen in recent years. I think the second half is what it needs to be, but it just feels like a little bit less imaginative to me. But I think what I need to get across about this is that this movie is just so incredibly smart about so many little details about perception and about the clueless things that white people do around black people in an attempt to seem self-aware. I think the way that it plays with structure and discomfort is really, really smart and like embedded in the narrative here. And then also in the sense of how this just balances so carefully between comedy and horror. And so I think there are a couple wonky turns, which we'll obviously talk about later. And I don't think the tone totally works for me, but like this is just great. This is exactly what I wanted from this. The performances are fantastic. Like everyone is just casted perfectly. Like we need to give an award to the casting director in here. Like making Catherine Keener and Bradley Whitford, who you know are just like these disarmingly sweet presences. Like making them just like into like subtly off players, and like Allison Williams, who is like playing a version of her character from Girls, and like Daniel Kaluuya, who is just. He's such an immersive presence in terms of as things happen, he's just an actor who you sink into those feelings with him. And it's just kind of a treat. I, again, more complicated feelings about where it goes, but this is really good. And I'm really happy that something like this exists.
Yeah. I'm gonna start off by saying that I enjoyed this movie a lot. I will say, however, that I'm probably, of the three of us, the person who is the least hot on it. So if at some point it sounds like I'm saying I didn't like this movie, or if I come off as too hard on it, it's only because I'm going to be counterbalancing two people who are much more effusive. At the same time, I liked every minute of this movie. I liked all of the performances. I thought Bradley Whitford was brilliant. I think that Allison Williams has a difficult role to play, and she does it very well. Catherine mm-hmm. Keener makes some very sudden and bizarre plots, like machinations, seem very logical. And, I mean... Daniel Kaluuya, I mean, this guy, he is the stereotypical like horror person who you just like 5 minutes in, you're like, what are you still doing there? Leave. But he makes it make sense in a way that I think is very socially aware on the part of the film. I think that the direction and the writing in this is super assured and really amazing. And yeah, I think that this is by and large a very good movie. I will say that I wasn't scared for a second of it.
This is oddly like it's kind of billed as a horror film, but this is more of like a thriller than anything.
Yeah. There's a sense, there's a creepiness to it.
Yes.
And there's definitely some tension, but it's not scary. So like
But there's like a very unique sensation to this as well, especially I'd say for white people, as weird as that sounds.
Yes. Please go on before I agree with you. Expound upon what you just said.
No, I can't get into it without
okay,
details.
So we'll get into it in spoilers. But yeah, I will say like I don't get scared at movies a lot. I get unnerved. I get like nervous about the being scared part. But rarely do movies actually scare me. I think we talked about The Descent on here once. It Follows legitimately gave me nightmares. This movie I was very engaged with, but I was never scared. There was like one sort of cheap jump scare that happens got me. But other than that, I was just like in a state of what is going on? This is really awkward in like the best way possible. And I'm willing to say that like if a movie engages me, even if it's billed as a horror movie or a romance and it doesn't do those things, I'm still on board. So I'm still on board with this movie. And a lot of that has to do with just how smart it is about portraying these like really awkward racial dynamics that just are like the most cringeworthiest. I was telling my wife about this after the movie was done. She didn't come and see it with me, but I said, it's very smart that this movie chooses people who have a racial prejudice and bias, but aren't like slathering vehement racists.
It's weird the way they kind of play out these characters is they're just almost not aware of the awkwardness that they're creating. They're trying to be nice. They're
so
going
accepting.
Out. Yeah. They're going out of their way to be reaching out to him. And it's so awkward. And you're just like, quit trying. Quit trying.
The awkward thing that all quote unquote thoughtful people have where it's like, oh, like here's the one black guy at the party. I'm going to go up and tell him I really like Public Enemy and that'll disarm him. Right. That'll make him know that like I'm one of his people. Or like, you know, I'll go up and say like, so, you know, Tiger Woods, right. He's pretty great. And, I told my wife, I was like, it's to the point where like, you feel like a more honest conversation would happen between an African American and just a full throated member of the KKK. Because like they would like, he's going to tell you what he thinks and it's going to be awful. It's going to be the worst conversation you've ever had, but there's a certain truth to it that is super obscured when like in this movie, Bradley Whitford's like, hey, that's my like grandfather. We're really proud of him because he lost to Jesse Owens. Like,
oh, that scene.
It's so awkward. And a lot of this movie reminds me of the episode of Atlanta.
Yeah, Juneteenth.
Yeah, yes.
which also, by the way, stars Lakeith Stanfield.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh man. But, so
wait, Brian. I just feel like the one other thing we have to say on this point is that like also the whole movie is delivered in this heightened like every line of dialogue has this weird like sense of italics around it, like purposefully.
Yeah.
Just so you're like, oh, because you're in on the. You're in on the joke, but you don't know what the joke is, to a sense.
So I will say that while this movie, for me, wasn't scary, it was fun. Like, this was a fun movie to watch, and it's the type of movie that we really don't get a lot of. And honestly, I know this is going to sound crazy. I think that this movie has more to say about race and the state of modern America than many other Oscar-nominated movies that I had to watch last year.
Oh, you're talking about La La Land? Is that what
or Birth
about?
Of a Nation?
Well, Birth of a Nation was an Oscar hopeful. I was talking about like Hidden Figures.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I mean like,
well, those films really what they do is they live kind of in that moment, and this film is examining that moment more than anything.
Yeah. I think this is like it's a great movie. It's great because also like even if you were an alien who didn't know anything about like the racial history of this country or like stereotypes related to the way that the races interact here, it just works on a level of, oh, this guy looks different from everyone else. And that's obviously a source of discomfort. Like it's a movie that works on a pure plot level as well as all of the deeper levels that you can look at if you'd like to.
It's literally hilarious that people are saying this doesn't have anything to say about race. I literally saw that take the other day.
I was
baffled.
What imbecile? What fucking idiot wrote that? Is it someone I know? I'm going to feel really bad if I said that.
I'm not putting the person on blast. I'm not doing that.
You already did.
Yep. In a way, you did.
I'm just empowered about it now.
Well, you know.
We're moving on. We're moving on.
Anyway, so any... Oh, also, the score for this movie is great. Mm-hmm. The opening credits and closing credits, like, theme are haunting.
The Appalachian, like, spiritual, like... it's almost like ravenous.
Yeah.
Well, I was also pretty excited that they weaved in a... Like, yeah, I like that song. All right.
Wait, can you say that again, Bill? You broke up a bit.
Oh, sorry. I was also pretty excited that they weaved in a Childish Gambino song from his new album, so that was pretty fun.
And also a very creepy old song. One of my favorite things for a horror movie to do is to use a discordant old happy song as a source of tension. This was done to its greatest effect.
In the Jeepers Creepers?
No, I was going to say the episode of the X-Files titled Home.
Oh, okay.
That's the one with the inbred cannibalistic monster guys.
I'll be honest. I've never seen a single episode of X-Files.
Oh, my God. Michael, have you seen?
I'm familiar with that episode. I've only seen the first two seasons of X-Files.
Okay. I think that's season four. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So yeah, that's all I'll say for that. We can get into the deeper themes and the plot and how they all tie together in the spoilers. Before we do that, does anyone have any final thoughts?
I'm ready.
All right. So that is Get Out. It is in theaters now. And is it still 100% on Rotten Tomatoes?
It is. Even with Armand.
God damn it.
Wow. Man. Even that guy didn't say something.
No. He said something bad.
What?
My wife asked, you know, is it 100% on Rotten Tomatoes good? And I said, yeah. And like I said, I'm not as enthusiastic about it as y'all appeared to be. But, like, people treat that like it's some crazy thing. But, like, it doesn't mean it's the best movie ever. It just means that everyone happened to like it.
Yes. Yeah, so, what would you ultimately have to pay attention to is the actual score that they usually have on the side, where it's like 7.3 out of 10 or something like that. And it's like, oh, okay, so like, people probably, like it, but they're not loving it. Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I can totally see this being a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes movie, but it's not an A-plus film for me. It's probably like a B.
Yeah, it is a B for me as well. It's like a 9 for me in the first half, or a 9 or an 8.5, and then maybe a 7.5 in the second half.
All right, well, let's get into it. Now we have spoilers for Get Out. So, there's a couple of things here. Okay, so I guess we'll just say what the conspiracy is. So, Allison Williams' character... Rose,
yes.
Says that Chris, who's played by Daniel Kaluuya, is her first black boyfriend, and there's like this awkwardness because her family is like trying to be inclusive, but it's being real weird about it. But then we find out that she actually is like their
honeypot.
Bait. Yeah, she's running a honeypot, and she is bringing people to this town. So that they can be hypnotized and then partially lobotomized
into the family
so that the white members of this community can then implant their own brains into these bodies as a means of taking them over, I guess. It's very dark. One of the things that I liked about it, though, was that fundamentally it maintains that same kind of insane racist jealousy, I guess? Or, like, it's the same thing that made him point to that picture of his grandfather and go, ah, he lost to Jesse Owens, good for him. It's like, you know... You're trying so hard not to be racist that you come back on yourself and become racist. So, like, when they're at the party and everyone's like, you know, I feel like being black is rather fashionable now. And it's like, oh, so is it true that you people are, like, stronger and bigger? And it's it's gross, but then it makes sense that these fucking weird old white people would want to become that.
Yes. Sure. Yeah. When their racism is awkward at first, and then it starts to make even more sense, and it comes back around on itself, and you're like, oh, holy shit, that's why they're like poking and prodding him, and saying, like, Caleb Landry Jones is like, it goes off on like an MMA rant, and he's like, you know, with your height and build, like, you would be a beast if you took time and practiced MMA. And, you know, even to the point where he's about to put him in a fucking headlock during a dinner conversation when they're first meeting him. And it's like, what is wrong with this guy? And it's like, well, because he's just like, he's trying to pick out people that he wants to be.
Yeah,
it's the point where, like, the explicitly and implicitly racist are, like, no longer separated. Like, they're just one in the same.
Well, because you're still othering this person. You're still like, I'm not racist. You know, I don't hate black people. I love how much stronger and, like, bigger they are than me. I love how cool they are, too. Like, oh, man, if I could just be a black guy. And it's just like, that's its own kind of problem. Like, it's like when people are like, I can't be racist against Asians. I am so jealous of how smart they are. It's like, bro, just calm down. Like, any time that you apply something to an entire group of people based purely on ethnicity or skin color, you're still being a goddamn racist.
Yes. Even if you're being nice.
Yeah. It's
I'm sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I was just about to freak out a bit.
One of my favorite random little things about a white person trying to define Daniel Kaluuya's character is when the blind art dealer is talking about how he has his assistant describe Daniel's photographs to him. And he goes, oh, the work is so brutal and so melancholic. Like, he's just like, it's that these people have created such specific definitions that are so specifically about, like, oppression, and so specifically not about seeing, like, people, even as you're saying, like, objectifying them down to their body parts and like these individual stereotypes as opposed to, like, anything.
The one thing that seems weird for me about this plot is that these white people are terrible at being black people. They are just awful at it. Like, we have Lakeith Stanfield, who we see get taken in the first scene. And, it seems as though he gets, like, a 60 to 70-year-old white man's brain put in his body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the guy is just terrible at it. Like, he's not good. He's not good at.
I imagine
these people are particularly adept at, like, utilizing their new vessel in a way that it would seem like they were trying to take advantage of when they took it in the first place.
Sure. The fist bump.
I think there's limited amounts of, and I like that. I like that it makes them hamstrung a bit. So even though they've taken over this body, they don't have full control, because obviously when a flash goes off, there's a period of relapse. And then also, it would stretch a little bit too much for me. It would go full out bonkers at that point if they weren't acting weird to me. I like that they act weird, because then it explains why they're acting weird. And it also explains why they're all wearing fucking hats. And I didn't realize that at first. And I was just like, oh, shit.
Now, here's the – I guess – is this what you thought it would be when you saw the trailer for this movie? Like, did you assume this was going to be an Invasion of the Body Snatchers type thing?
So – I thought the hypnosis and all of this stuff that you see kind of prominently in the trailer, I thought that was going to happen in the last, like, 20 minutes, right? I thought it was going to go full out bonkers at that point. I didn't realize that he was going to get hypnotized within the first 20 minutes of this film. Yeah. And and that they weren't going to beat around the bush. They kind of tiptoe around it, and then they full out just say and confirm, yes, he got hypnotized last night. And you're just like, wait. Yeah, Nobody does that.
He says to his friend, like, yeah, her mom hypnotized me last night. And his friend, who is
like,
great,
what the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love him.
His name is Rod. And yeah. He's just like, get it. What are you doing? Get out of there. Like, you know, white people love turning people into sex slaves. Like, get out.
Yeah, his Jeffrey Dahmer rant was hilarious. It lit up my crowd. My crowd was having a ball during that moment.
My crowd was silent.
Really?
Yeah, I think they were very uncomfortable about when to laugh. So there was scattered
laughs. Who did you see it with?
No, I saw it in a full crowd.
At just press screening or?
No, on a Friday night.
Jesus, where did you fucking see this?
10 a.m. on a Saturday morning, and it was me and like four other people, all of whom were very old, and they loved it. It was very strange. I wish that I had seen this at like a 7 o'clock Saturday screening. I will say, there's so many places that a movie like this could go, because when you're looking at, like the more liberal forms of racism, just to put it in its most cliched way.
Sure.
Like, there's a lot of different places that it could go, and I can't decide if I'm not good with the fact that it went there, but I can't decide if this is the most fertile way for it to go. I do like the fact that, like, it's a bunch of old white people who seem to be wanting to take advantage of, like, the shifts in social decorum that they've seen, where suddenly it seems like, hey, black people are kind of on top in these very superficial ways that matter a lot to us because we have everything we want. I was sort of expecting that the movie was going to go more in an assimilationist way, where it's like, you know, oh, we love black people so much that we wanted to help them, so we're going to, like, defang them and make them
white as fuck.
White.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's, I was kind of expecting that.
Interesting. Yeah.
Which I think would have.
One thing I want to. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think it would have been interesting, but also I think that I'm having trouble deciding whether I like that idea more than this one, because, mm-hmm. like I said, there is something kind of fiendishly clever about, you know, as the art dealer says when they're having their conversation, like, you know, some people it's fashionable, some people it's a strength thing. Like, I like that idea because that's something that very rarely gets sussed out, and very rarely do people say, like, openly, I would love to be a black person.
Yes, because they have so many physical attributes that are beneficial and this, that, and the other, and it's like, uh-huh, okay, but yeah,
it's,
sure.
It's that fucking idiot that you knew in high school who wanted to be a rapper, but he was white.
Sure.
And he's like, man, I wish I'd been born black. Or like the movie Beginners, when the mother is talking about how, like, music made by black people is the best because they've suffered the most.
Jesus.
Again, it's from the movie Beginners, and she says, like, them and the Jews. And it's just like, all right, you can think that, but you probably shouldn't say it out loud. But I guess at that point, that was, like, maybe the 70s. But she still shouldn't have been saying it out loud.
Are you talking about the Mike Mills movie?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't remember that scene, but all right.
She's playing a record for her son.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. I do want to mention something that I kind of picked up on that I think is kind of hilarious and also pretty awesome is this film, of all the iconic horror imagery of, like, weapons and things that you want to avoid, I never thought a teacup would be one of them.
That was,
And this film makes a teacup into a fucking nightmare. Like, you're just like, oh God, there's that teacup. And they even have, like, he is smart enough. Jordan Peele is smart enough to realize he's built up this imagery around this teacup.
Sure.
Let's go ahead and have a sequence where there's a show showdown over that
exactly
teacup,
the same way that two characters would usually rush for a gun.
Yes.
They rush for a teacup. It's amazing.
And you're just like, yes, this movie is giving me everything that I want. What I love especially about this movie is you're right, Brian. 5 minutes in, you're like, okay, he needs to get the hell out of here. But that's because we know so much more than he does, right? But at a certain point, it gets to be too much. And he starts to freak out right when I'm like, no, this is the point of no return, where usually a lot of people in horror films take another 15 to 20 minutes. And he's like, no, we got to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
And at that point, when he realizes that Allison Williams probably is not on his side. Right. Yeah. And even the audience, Jordan Peele is smart enough to kind of give us little hints, but also keep leading us around, because there is this idea of hypnotism and we don't quite know who is hypnotized in this place, who is being taken over. We at this point are under the impression that these helping hands are kind of hypnotized, right? And so they're acting kind of against their will. And we think maybe Allison Williams is in that same boat a little bit. And she does a good job of kind of selling that, where she can't find her keys and she's not quite freaking out as much as he is, because he hasn't explained anything.
Yeah.
And so she's just like, okay, I can't find the keys. And you're like, oh, shit, why can't she find the keys right now?
Yeah,
and then when
she's hypnotized into not seeing them. Yeah.
Yes. And then when she holds up the keys,
the way she plays that moment is so great.
But what does he do? He has a camera bag in his hand, and as soon as – like, the sound design in this film is fucking phenomenal. As soon as she holds up and jingles the keys and she's like, I had them all along, he drops the camera bag and kind of bows up. And he's just like – and you as the audience, you're like, oh, he's about to just, like, try and bum rush everybody. Like, find the weak link. And, of course – I don't know why he goes after Caleb Landry Jones, because, I mean, yes, he is probably the smallest of all the people there, but he's also kind of positioned himself as a big fan of MMA, and I'm like,
but at the same, well, Bill, maybe don't think about it. If you think about it logically, when you have a group of people, you want to attack the strongest one first. Because
sure, because you don't want that person having, you don't want that person hitting you upside the head.
Right.
You
also,
know,
because
you're
like
with everybody else.
Assuming that you took out the three other people at the end, you're going to be kind of tired. Like, I would probably save Catherine Keener for last.
Yes. And
even
unfortunately,
half exhausted, I might have a chance against her.
Yes. And unfortunately, she has that damn teacup. Doesn't work out too well for him.
No, that was fucked up. This is another okay. So, like, Michael, it's funny because you said you didn't really like the latter half of this movie. I loved it.
Yeah, because I really appreciate it.
There's something about my personality, and I think this is why I like the John Wick movies so much. Where there's nothing that I love more in a movie than when someone just goes crazy and just starts hurting everyone. So, like, a good revenge narrative. It really gets to me and, like, makes me happy. So when he picks up that bocce ball,
maybe righteous revenge is
when John Wick's dog dies, everything he does from that point on is justified in my brain. And when this guy, like, you know, because he's got that nervous tick about, like, scratching at the arm posts. And he fills his ears with cotton so that he can hear the tap.
I love that.
That was great.
I love that. Yeah.
And then he fucking brains Caleb Landry Jones with a bocce ball. And then he, like, 6 points Bradley Whitford with a deer's head. I was just like, I was cheering in the theater. Which is, again, why I said, like, I didn't find this movie terrifying or scary, but I was definitely on board. And my one fucking issue was that he does that stupid horror movie thing where it's like, if you know that the sound of a teacup tapping is going to knock you out, Fucking keep the cotton in your ears.
Yes, that's what I was thinking too. I was like, damn it, what are you doing? Why'd you take the fucking things out of? But then what it does is it sets up the teacup situation. So I'm not unhappy about that happening because
I was
ultimately
unhappy in the moment.
Didn't end up playing out the way that you were like, oh no, you don't be a dumbass and do that and then have that come back and haunt you. But yeah, so I was happy it went that direction.
Now the one scene that I did have trouble with was when his friend Rod, who works for the TSA, goes to the police.
Yeah.
Well, because why?
Okay.
Honestly, I don't know about you, Michael, but for me it was mainly aesthetic. That whole scene looked so much uglier and cheaper than the rest of this movie.
It did not have the clean kind of. It was lit weird.
Yeah,
I found it was lit weird. I found it was lit like a stage.
Yeah,
in a
and
way.
Then that made the dialogue harder to process too. But Michael, what were you going to say?
I am probably in the minority, and I think that Little Rel Howery is very talented, and I liked every time he was on screen, but I felt that especially the tangent you're referring to where we switch to him after Chris's character been hypnotized, after he's under, and we switch to Little Rel Howery's character, Rod's character for a while. I think that whole tangent is disruptive in a way that doesn't really add to the movie. I think there's some interesting scenes in there. I mean, it doesn't – I'm sure it's not that much in terms of actual runtime. I'm sure it's probably 10 minutes, that whole sequence. But there is something about that that just feels a little bit underwritten to me. Like they weren't – and I do partly like that they cover that Chris is sleeping during this and that they've already identified Rod earlier in the movie. So they're not just going to let it fall out of the wayside. But there is something about that whole cop plot line that just like it leans too hard into comedy for me in that scene. And I think it just undermines the tone a little bit. And I do think sometimes the comedy in this is a little bit misjudged at times. Especially
I think that if they hadn't gone to the police station. Like, if they just cut out that scene, which, like I said, it's aesthetically not great either, that it would be fine. But I feel like...
Do you like the phone call?
The phone call was fine. I thought that was actually...
Let's keep on target. Let's work one thing at a time, guys.
Well, well no, because...
It's part of the same sequence.
Yeah, it's all the Rod stuff. I mean, like, if you could take out the police station... But I feel like someone said, like, hey, it's kind of weird that this guy just doesn't try to go to the cops.
Exactly.
I think you didn't have to have that, like, comedy beat where she brings everyone in.
Yes.
And he kind of makes an ass of himself. But that phone call with Allison Williams was chilling.
It was.
It is.
I love that. Yeah. And I love that he, like, they use technology, right? Because they're like... And he doesn't fuck it up. Like, he's not such a dumbass in that moment where he's going to unmute, right, at the wrong time or something like that. Like, he uses technology. He uses a speakerphone. He's like, okay, I'm going to put this on mute. He says the thing that we're all thinking. And then he records her. And what does she do? She flips a switch. And it's almost like she knew that he was, like, trying to pick up on things. And it was just like, oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Like she's fucking devious. Like she's smart.
Sure.
You know?
He does use Bing though, and that's pretty crazy.
I have avoided making any jokes about it, but I was going to call this Jordan Peele's Get Out brought to you by Microsoft.
By Windows? Yeah.
yeah.
Because it's definitely everyone has Windows phones, everyone uses Windows
the
PCs
Surface,
and tablets,
yeah.
and they use Bing.
I understand so much about like how a film is funded now that stuff just doesn't bother me much.
No, that's not a legitimate issue. I'm just being
it's just funny.
Yeah, no.
I will say though, it does take me out of a movie whenever someone uses Bing.
because
no one uses Bing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like it's not even like it's when someone's drinking a Pepsi. And I'm like, it's like if someone were drinking,
it's like using
some terrible drink that no one ever drinks.
Mr. Pibb.
Yeah. It's like if someone were drinking a Mr. Pibb, that would throw me off.
Oh, no one does well, that. There we go. Favorite movie of the year, Hell or High Water. Only assholes drink Mr. Pibb.
There you go. That's true. Just to wrap us up, I wanted to throw out a couple of other
scenes. Wait, I wanted to say some things about why I dislike the second half, or why I think it's a little bit of a missed opportunity.
Okay, at what point do you define the second half beginning?
Sure. I guess the part where I do start to go a little bit downhill on it is probably about the time that he is hypnotized and wakes up and starts seeing a video about the Coagula, the family.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I would say about this is one thing we didn't talk about yet is that the whole thing about the hypnosis is it's such a great piece of psychological horror. So you have that interesting visual that actually a listener pointed out is reminiscent of Under the Skin. The listener was Thomas Keller. He tweeted me and he was saying how when they sink into what is it called? The Sunken? Is that what? That's not what
it's called.
Place.
The Sunken Place.
Thanks, Bill. So that has this really interesting visual of him being, you know, just in this negative space. But what I found so interesting psychologically about that is Catherine Keener's terrifying explanation about how he's going to just be a sliver of himself and a passenger. And like, so I think what is a little bit disappointing to me about that second half is that after we get so much about the pure terror for this character of what it means to have their body taken over, I guess I should say I do kind of like when he realizes, because just this is where obviously the subtextual aspect of him being a black character surrounded by whites becomes all the more powerful, realizing what's going to happen next. And they're like, oh, no, we're not really racist. We just believe in being the best possible human beings, which, you know, obviously is, as you were saying, Brian, just like another another disguised form of white supremacy. What it is about.
Yeah, it's like
the point where the violence starts is it starts rushing a little bit for me there, and it wants to incorporate all of the things. You know, you get the story with his mom, how his mom was in a hit and run and he could have done something about that. And that comes back into play with the grandma, which I thought was just a little bit too neat. There's just something about the way that the first half feels so organic to me, and the second half is still delivered by these people that make these insane plot machinations seem relatively logical. Mm-hmm. But it is just at a certain point it gains this momentum and is rolling down a hill. And I do wish it would just slow down a little bit. Like, to take, for example, like when he kills Caleb Landry Jones, it's not like 2 minutes later that he's already killed the father. And then, like, you know, there's the mother encounter. Like, all of that is just – it's inevitable.
I take all of that and I flip it because I love that it rushes through that, because that's exactly what I want him to do. I don't want him to slow burn, beat all these people. I want him to surprise every single one of them and get the upper hand and use his physical force to kind of upend them, because they're not expecting him to be smart enough to kind of get around some of these situations.
Yeah.
And they don't have backup plans. And so what does he do? He uses the objects around him to his advantage. Like the scene when he gores Bradley Whitford.
Like,
I love that scene because it was just so effective. It was so smart. It set up that the house was going to be on fire. It also dealt with everything that could happen in that sequence. And it was like he used an object that was at his disposal at that time to kind of get the upper hand. And like, it was boom, 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 boom. And it was all of those things that in so many horror films take 30 minutes for them to kind of get at one after the other and get some of these situations out of the way. This film does that in 5 minutes because you're like, that's what I want my character to do. I want him to get the fuck out of that place as fast as human possible.
Yeah, I agree with Bill on this one. I'll agree with Bill on that point, but then I got to agree with you, Mike, on something else. I love the rapidity of the escalation of violence towards the end, because I'm down with him just like deciding to go for it. But I do like when he hits Georgina and then like stops to pick her up. I was like, okay, like that's just a little too much. Like,
yeah,
it's very. It is the way that most first-time feature films especially are written, where they want to be so tight, they want to be so neat, that they feel the need to bring that in.
Keanu kind of had something like that too, if I remember correctly. Like a last-minute thing that comes back right at the end.
I don't remember. I do want to see that movie again, though. That's a funny-ass movie.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Brian.
Go, Mike.
No, please. Go ahead.
I just want to talk about all I want before this is over is to say how chilling and well directed and well acted the silent auction scene is.
Oh my god. Yes.
And how much sense it makes after the fact. Right? Because you're like, you don't have a fucking clue what is going on during that moment. At least I didn't. I was just like, this doesn't make any damn sense. And then all of a sudden, you're like, oh, that's what they were doing? Oh,
yeah,
that's like, creepy as fuck.
I was still at the point then when I thought that they were just brainwashing black people to make them like, white, and so like basically it was going to be slavery. I didn't realize at that point that it was
undercover
like,
brother.
That I didn't realize that it was going to be like who wants to chill in this guy's body.
Yep.
And yeah, like Mike, you I believe earlier had said something about like the whole different kind of racism that is, and it is like oh man, if only my white brain could be in that superior black body, I'd be a god. Like, that's just super fucked up. Like, what a terrible way to look at the world. Anyway, Michael, you had something else you were going to say?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I'd just say is I see what you guys are saying about that, especially how it's this catharsis after, like, this whole movie of him being trapped. But there is just a little bit of a tonal shift there. And I think also just that it starts giving into what a lot of the genre elements and what I expect. But I do have to say, with that said, like I have come up on the second half in the last couple of days, particularly because I've read a couple of things. And there's one piece I just want to suggest real quick. So Ira Madison at MTV wrote a piece called Get Out Understands the Black Body. And he was talking about, I'm paraphrasing his piece here badly, but I just wanted to say briefly about this because it recontextualized the whole movie for me, is that the entire genre of horror is about harm to, watching harm to bodies. Like that is the thrill of, you know, watching horror movies. It's seeing how people's, you know, fragility is, or how people are put at their most vulnerable spot. Thank you. And what's so interesting about that is it's, you know, with so many horror films, it's generally white men who are one of the last people, or white women, and especially for white men, like it's a thrill to watch, you know, them be the last one, but you're not really, there's not really like a genuine terror that this could happen to you. But then for women and for black people, like you think of the history of the genre, which is what Ira Madison gets into a little bit, is that, you know, even things like Night of the Living Dead, where the original one, where, you know, the character has done everything right, but it still, you know, ends poorly for them. Or or Rosemary's Baby, for instance, where women are invaded. So, like, what it is about Get Out is it's like a rebuttal to like the past century of horror movies where a black man gets to be the final, you know, he gets to be the final person, and he finally gets to gets to get revenge for those years and years of being an object and being a prop and things like that.
Not only that, but like in the movie, you can even see how like his whole being is to set white people at ease. Mm-hmm. Dealing with the cop and like dealing with all the white people at the party. His whole thing is like, I don't want these people to view me as a threat. I'm just going to go along to get along. And it's usually the type of character that we get in these movies anyway. I mean, if you look at something like Straw Dogs, it's very similar. But there's like a whole other level, because that is, as we've learned in the wake of just countless shootings and people writing essays about it, like the black experience is often, what do I have to do to make it known that I'm not a threat so that my life isn't threatened?
And absolutely. This is,
yeah, and this is a guy who his life is threatened and it doesn't matter. So now he gets to, I don't want to say cut loose, but he gets to be the threat. And I think that there is, again, on a basic plot level and also on a social level, something really awesome about that.
Last shot is just one of the best sight gags I've seen in years, where the police car goes up and you think it's just going to be.
Yeah.
Like, it's such an easy idea, but it's so perfect coming after everything else.
I was wondering there's a moment. It was going to be like that, what is it? Night of the Living Dead type.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. There's a moment when she says, I still love you. And he starts to wrap his fingers around her throat. And you're like, uh-oh, there's going to be bloody fingerprints around her throat. And then all of a sudden the cop car arrives and you're like, well, shit, this is not going to be a good situation. Because we've already seen it play out when his buddy, Rod, is trying to explain to the cops what happened. And you're like, yeah, this sounds improbable as fuck. And there's a great moment when Rod is like coming through theories and he scratches out magic isn't real. He's like, damn it. And you're just like, yes, like they are smart enough to like realize that all of this sounds improbable as fuck unless you're living that situation.
Yeah.
Right. Unless you're in it. You're just like, this doesn't make any fucking sense.
When
the cop car door
opens and I just saw the word airport on it, I like clapped. I was like,
everybody in my audience like cheered. They were all like, yes, because it got silent as hell for like 5 seconds. And it was just like, ooh.
I was 100% certain this movie was about to get real dark.
Yes, I was too.
Well, but,
Brian,
I feel like I got to go back to one other thing I was saying earlier, because I was saying that this has a different type of terror for white people. And I feel like I got to clarify that, don't I?
Yeah, if you want.
I feel like I should. So what I was going to say is part of why I find the structure of this so smart is the sense that for at least a little while, I think some audience members, myself included, was feeling a surrogacy with, you know, Allison Williams' character for a little while, or people that you can identify that white people can identify more readily with. Like, that doesn't mean I don't identify with Chris's character at all, but rather that, like, there is something about Allison Williams in people I know. You know, people who are trying to be well-intentioned but still say clueless shit all the time.
Right. When
every time she does one of her little
rants against the
police officer rant, for instance.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say is so interesting about this. In the same way as the one scene in Birth of a Nation I really like is the rebellion, which is something that has stuck with me and was so interesting and visceral to watch. I think this movie has a similar, very complicated set of reactions to it. Because, you know, in the sense of certain people watching this and worrying, oh, am I this? You know, that, or not am I this, but I have been this and I can be, I need to do better. Like, that's what I'm saying. Is there an element here that goes past your average horror film? I guess that's
a problem. Is it a problem that the movie doesn't give, like, any kind of guidance on how to be better?
No.
Okay.
I don't think in any way, like, that's the equivalent of asking someone how I can be a better ally.
I don't have a problem with the movie not doing that. I am perfectly fine with everyone on screen except for Chris and Rod being monstrous. And the dog.
I'm saying that's what I was trying to get across earlier.
Yeah, I can just see the think pieces happening where it's like, you know, oh, Get Out is nihilistic about racism because there's never a point at which it says, like, what to do. But yeah,
it's pretty realistic, honestly.
Well, yeah, I mean, the guy, it's funny because the guy who is the least racist is the guy who wants to take over Chris's body.
Oh, Stephen Root?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, all these other people, like, they don't know what real life is. Like, I'm blind. I got all this stuff going on. You're a great artist. I don't really see
fucking eyes.
You're black. He's like, but you can see, and I want that. So I think that that's actually the better thing, is that I think a smart choice, among many smart choices in this movie, is that he wasn't won, quote unquote, by a guy who was racist. He was won by a guy who's still just willing to exploit other people to get what he wants.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Caleb Landry Jones is a dirty looking weird son of a bitch who will never not be a dirty looking weird son of a bitch.
Well, wasn't this big movie that the heroin addiction movie?
Oh, I was going to say X-Men First Class.
Yes.
Contraband, antiviral.
Oh, you're talking about the movie with the two kids that are bums on the street.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, heaven knows what. Yeah. He plays a character that is unrecognizable in heaven knows what. He is shaggy like a motherfucker.
He's getting shaggy like a motherfucker. All right. So I think that we have talked to death about this.
Wait, guys, a weird thing. He's also the boy on the bike at the end of No Country for Old Men.
Oh, that's weird.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's his first thing. Interesting. All right. So let's clean this up. We're all done for today. Guys, have either of you looked at Twitter or Facebook while we were recording?
Yeah, unfortunately. Okay.
So yeah,
you guys want to say anything about any of his performances?
Well, first we should say
I fucking love
that
him.
To anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about, Bill Paxton passed away during the recording of this.
And I was unfortunately, I have a friend on Facebook that was posting about this yesterday. Apparently there was a rumor yesterday.
Yeah, there was.
And it was debunked, and then now he's dead. So I'm just like topsy-turvy. I feel my stomach is in knots because I was prepared for it yesterday, and now I went to bed knowing, no, that was bullshit. And then now I wake up and it's like, nope, it's real. I'm just like, ugh.
Yeah, it sucks. Bill Paxton, you know what's funny?
62.
I almost just said Independence Day. And
yeah,
I'm
no,
not usually
one
of those people who has problems with Bill Paxton, Bill Pullman. In fact, I just have a very clear image of Bill Paxton fighting aliens in the movie Aliens.
Sure.
And also
in Independence Day.
And not Independence Day. And in Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't know. I just wanted to put that out there.
Two of my favorite films are actually from childhood are Aliens and Twister. I rewatched both of those movies so much. And yeah, he is fantastic in both of those films.
He is great in? True Lies.
He's good in that too.
He's the bad guy in that, isn't he?
He's like a slimy fucking asshole. Yeah. He's not like a terrorist. He's just a liar.
Oh, he's not the terrorist that just happens to be like from a Muslim country.
Oh yeah, that's right. Oh my god, I just remember the ending of that movie.
Yeah. But right.
I want to recommend an underseen I don't know if either of you guys seen A Simple Plan?
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
It's a Sam Raimi a movie.
Isn't that with Joseph Gordon-Levitt? No, that's the wrong one. I'm thinking of something.
It's Bill Paxton, Billy Bob Thornton, and Bridget Fonda. It's about they discover a plane with $4 million in cash, and from there, stuff happens. It's based on a great book. It's a great movie. I would highly recommend people check it out.
He's also in obviously Titanic.
Until Dark.
Apollo 13. Yeah.
This guy had a hell of a career.
He was Haywire. I don't remember that, but I own that movie.
I remember him.
I'll watch that.
I remember
today.
Him.
U-571, really good submarine movie.
I do, in fact, love U-571. I had a submarine kick for a while. I have like 14 like Tom Clancy-esque techno thrillers about submarine warfare. I don't know why. But, yeah, so that's just some sad news we wanted to put out there. Bill Paxton has passed away.
Oh, Tombstone. It's great in Tombstone, too.
And like Bill, like you said, like I remember seeing last night, like, oh, Bill Paxton's passed away. And then people are like, no, he didn't. And I'm like, well, that's stupid. Why would you say that then? And now I just want to know what the story is there. Like, did he nearly die and then he passed away today? Like, he finally succumbed?
It was surgery complications, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we will see him again in The Circle, which comes out this year.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm going to go watch a Bill Paxton movie.
I'm going to go watch Haywire. that's all for today. Let me remind everyone to go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will be able to get a free 30-day trial of MUBI. MUBI, the streaming online cinema, where every day their curators give you a hot new film to enjoy. You have 30 days to watch, and then it disappears into the ether. Currently, they're going to be doing their Three Views from North Korea film series that gives you a peek behind the curtain into that much-talked-about country. So that is it. Go to mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. All right, gentlemen, let's tell the fine people where we can be found between now and next week when we will be talking about Logan. Bill Graham.
You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on the Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snidell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snidell, where I'll be goring anyone who disagrees with me. And
okay, wait. I just said, have you all seen Deadwood?
No, unfortunately not.
Oh, God damn it. There's a point in Deadwood where someone like does that whole pick a guy up and throw him into a wall thing. But
oh, nice.
But there's a fucking deer's head mounted on the wall.
Yeah.
And so he accidentally gores him, and someone very nonchalantly just says, oh shit, Dan just 12-pointed Slippery Bill. And so I nearly said that in the middle of the theater when he stabbed him with the buck's head. Anyway, go ahead. You're going to be goring people on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm going to be goring people on Twitter, and you can read my writing at the Film Stage. And I'll have a review of the documentary called The Settlers next week, so look for that.
All right, excellent. And you can, of course, find me on Twitter flipping out over every single award that La La Land wins at the Academy Awards, at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find me everywhere else under at Brian J. Rowan. And you can find my writing at thefilmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. And remember to tune in next week when we will be reviewing Logan.
Friday that ever comes along, I get up early and sing this little song. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, bang.